This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read. The podcast of The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism, with episodes about everything from the rise of ADHD to the double life of an alleged Russian spy. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.
As you've heard me say many times, we have more liquid gold under our feet than any nation on earth. It's called Drill Baby Drill.
Britain is back in the business of climate leadership, getting serious about shifting away from fossil fuels. Every major company with proper climate plans, the first major country in the world to set the goal of clean power by 2030.
When we say that growth is the number one mission of this government, we mean it, and that means it trumps other things.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Well, hello.
Hello.
This morning we're joined by a special guest, Kieran. He's been an MP for the last 20 years. He was leader of the Labour Party and served in the cabinet of the last Labour government, as well as now under Keir Starmer as Energy and Net Zero Secretary. Welcome, Ed Miliband.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a former podcaster as well, and podcasters of the world unite. So I feel very privileged to be in the Guardian studio.
You're looking very at ease, I have to say.
Oh, well, I don't know. Let's see. But no, it's...
Your advisor tells me you have podcast mode. So I'm looking forward to seeing podcast mode in
evolve. I have some podcast envy. We were just saying... Before the microphone was switched on, maybe I should restart my own.
Oh, I think you should, for sure. I wanted to start by just asking you about your day job in government. Yeah. And are you the only member of the previous cabinet who came back this time around? Yvette Cooper?
Yeah, I think I'm the only person who's come back to do the same job.
Right? I mean, that is unusual with a 15-year gap.
Is it
different this time around? Does it feel different? Do you feel that you're better at the job this time around?
Well, to all your listeners who can imagine what they were doing 16 years ago, I strongly recommend going back to doing what you were doing 16 years ago. Well, because you can always do it better. You can sort of learn from what you did right, what you did wrong, how you do the job. David Cameron said to me, I ran into him at something, and he said to me, we compared experiences of going back into government, having been in government and then out. And he said, well, what's interesting, he said, is you know how to do it, you just have to work out what to do. And I think there is certainly, I don't say it's easy at all, the government is not easy, but I feel quite privileged being able to go back and in a way making similar arguments to the ones we made 16 years ago, but also different arguments, because this is very much an argument we're making about the clean energy transition, being about energy security, being about jobs and growth, and about climate. And that's a slightly different argument than the one I would have made last time.
Well, 16 years ago, I was at home with a 10-day-old baby, my first child. So I'm quite happy not to go back to that again. Thanks very much.
Okay, fair enough.
But tomorrow, the long-awaited planning bill is going to be come before Parliament. It includes things like giving residents who live near power infrastructure, like pylons or onshore wind farms, a bit of cash.
Yeah.
Maybe to help win them over, keep them on side. Yeah. Talk us through all of that.
So, look, the argument that we're making is we need to build a clean energy infrastructure to power the country forward. We've got to build multiple times more clean energy infrastructure in the coming years than we've built in the last 20 or 30 years. And why are we doing this? Because we know that at the moment, we're so exposed to fossil fuel markets controlled by petrostates and dictators. We've seen the energy price cap go up again. That's because the global gas price has gone up. And clean homegrown power is an answer to that. Now, it's the right thing to do, but if you live near one of this transmission infrastructure, you're doing a service on behalf of the country in many ways. And so what we are announcing today is saying that people will get bill discounts of up to £250 a year for 10 years if they live within a certain vicinity of power lines. And there'll be wider community benefits too. And that's a recognition that we're asking people in different areas of the country to kind of live with these this transmission infrastructure. We think it's right for the country, but we also think, and we said this in our manifesto, there should be direct benefits for them.
You also said before the election that bills would be cut by 300 quid. Do you think they still...
Up to £300 is what we said, and by 2030, and we stand by that. Look, we believe, and this is the key thing, we believe that the important thing about renewables is it's just a much cheaper system to run. And sure, there are costs of building that infrastructure, but you can spread that building the infrastructure over a long period. So we believe it will give lower bills. We also believe it gives just much greater security, because the truth is we are so exposed at the moment as a country. You know, as I say, the price cap went up again. That's just to do with global markets. And we've got to get off those global markets.
Can I ask you about a piece of infrastructure that you're going to have to take a decision over coming up, which is Rosebank? This is this enormous oil field off the coast of Shetland, which does have a license, but is now having to resubmit its environmental planning application because of a ruling in the Supreme Court recently that it had to account for its carbon emissions in a different way. The judgment that came through the courts said that the developers of that oil field need to account for the carbon emissions that are produced from burning the oil that they produce. And the oil industry says, wait a second, that's completely unfair. This is our only product. Well, why should we be treated differently from other industries where they don't have to account for the costs of whatever they produce? I mean, do you have any truck with that argument?
I abide by the rule of law. And the Supreme Court made a really important decision, which is that, as you say, Kieran, so-called scope 3 emissions, so the impact of burning oil and gas, needs to be accounted for. We've undertaken a consultation, and we will respond to that consultation, setting out how we will account for these scope 3 emissions, and then developers will come forward with their proposals. But that Supreme Court decision was a recognition of the impact of the climate crisis, and obviously we'll abide by it.
Do you think that they will come and look at that Supreme Court decision in years to come and think, oh, that was a moment something really fundamental changed?
I think it was a landmark judgment, honestly. I think it was a landmark judgment domestically and probably internationally as well. And it's based in the rule of law and the laws that Parliament has passed, but I think it is very, very significant. And it concerns something called the environmental impact assessment that my department makes of projects. And previously, it didn't take account of these scope 3 emissions, and now we'll have to.
Now, we're at a moment where the consensus that has existed on climate change for many years seems to have come to an end. Donald Trump promised when he was elected to drill, baby, drill. And here in the UK, obviously, Reform are vocal about not supporting the green transition. How much damage do you worry might be done over the next 4 years?
Look, different countries will make different decisions on what they decide on these issues. And President Trump is a duly elected president of America, and he obviously has to make his own decisions. I think what's interesting to me is when you go around internationally, this transition is happening and it is unstoppable. I just came back from India. I'm shortly going to China. It's so striking being in India. Prime Minister Modi says that net zero is net positive. They see the economic opportunities. Lots of countries of the world see the economic opportunities. If you look at the lesson of the first Trump term, the rest of the world carried on because it made economic sense. And I think that is the big change that I was indicating earlier. The big change is not just that in the long term, this is the right thing to do, but in the short term, there's greater energy security from the transition and there's massive economic opportunities. Just to give you one fact, the CBI recently published a survey saying that the net zero economy grew 3 times faster than the economy as a whole in the UK. So that's the big opportunity.
But we're not seeing other countries taking their feet off the pedal then, or even companies. I mean, BP, within days of the inauguration, made a decision to reprioritise its focus.
Well, look, the BP thing is interesting because the reason BP made that decision is because of pressures from shareholders. And obviously talk to BP about this, about the scale of returns they get from fossil fuels versus the scale of returns they get from renewables. In other words, they get greater returns from fossil fuels in their perception. Now, in a way, that is why the role of government is so important, because the government has got to make decisions like we are doing on the whole issue around North Sea licenses to say, well, look, companies have got their incentives to invest, but government has got to think about the wider national interest. And just going back to your point about can we win the argument? Well, internationally, I think yes. Domestically, I think yes too, because the public, all of the survey evidence and all of the discussions I have with people say people get that homegrown clean renewables can give us much greater security than fossil fuels can. And that is the big change in the argument, I think.
Something else I think that's changed over the last 15, 16 years is the role of some of the environmental campaign groups. Become almost part of our daily life. When you were energy secretary last time around, I don't think Just Stop Oil was around. Extinction Rebellion was in its infancy, I guess, at that time. Some of those groups basically helped change the conversation. I don't know if you'd agree, but seem to have helped change the conversation around net zero and the green agenda. Are you comfortable when you see Just Stop Oil protesters being thrown in jail and you know, people who've potentially done as much as anybody else to bring the conversation around to some of the things that you think, then getting penalised for that?
Well, look, I said earlier on that it's really important to uphold the rule of law, and I'm not going to sort of comment on individual sentences and decisions, because I think it is really, really important, and this is something the Prime Minister takes incredibly seriously, and rightly so. I think what's striking about the last few years is that the youth protesters, the climate Fridays for the Future, so-called young people, did have a real effect and a positive effect in the sort of 2019 period. Honestly, I think some of the tactics of Just Stop Oil and XR have ended up alienating lots of people, and I don't think it's been helpful to the cause, really. And, you know, I'm sure some of the people involved in it got decent motivations, but I'm just very struck by those protests on the M25. You had people who were trying to get to sick relatives and so on, and I don't believe that is a way to win people over to your cause. So I think you've always got to be thinking, when you know, the right to peaceful protest is incredibly important, but you've always got to be thinking, how are we winning people over to the just cause that we believe we have, or are we alienating people? And I'm sorry to say that lots of these tactics have alienated people.
So Ed, back in 2023, Rachel Reeves described herself as wanting to be the first Green Chancellor. Be interested to know how you think she's doing on that. And the reason we ask that is because, as you'll remember, in late January, she gave her blessing to a third runway at Heathrow Airport. It must have been a pretty depressing day for you.
I think that Rachel is absolutely committed to this agenda, honestly. I know from my discussions with her, and I know from the decisions she's made. In the budget last year, the department that got the biggest settlement in terms of spending uplift was my department. That's because Rachel absolutely sees, and she said that in the speech she made on infrastructure, she absolutely sees growth and net zero as going together, that this is the thing that can drive her number one mission, which is growth. And so whatever specific decisions are made, I know that she's really, really committed to this agenda.
I'll ask you about another slightly contentious thing. I think you were part of the Treasury team that initially put in the winter fuel payments. And when you were working for Gordon Brown, they've obviously been cut.
I'm that old.
You don't look it. You don't look it.
I'm
just fishing for compliments there.
But I don't want to necessarily specifically ask about that decision, but we've also got more welfare cuts apparently to come, up to kind of £6 billion worth of welfare cuts about to be announced. How does it feel to be part of a government that's unrolling much of that agenda that you helped put in place when you were working for Gordon Brown?
Well, look, just on the welfare reform point, I was in opposition, indeed, I'm the even more old, with Gordon when we devised a New Deal for young people, which was all about giving people opportunities to work. Opportunity for those who can, security for those who can't was, I think, our mantra. I know from Liz Kendall that that's what she is determined to do. You know, she sees a system that writes off lots of people by the way the system works and doesn't give people help to get into work. I know from my discussions with Liz, this agenda of giving security to those who can't, but opportunity to those who can, is something she's so, you know, really, really committed to. She is worried about the increasing sort of incidence of people who are dropping out of the labour market. And I think that is her central motivation. And obviously, she'll make her announcements in due course.
Now, obviously, in Cabinet, there was a lot of support and across the party for boosting defence spending. We live in very uncertain times and Europe needs to step up. But that was done at the expense, in the announcement a couple of weeks ago, of the foreign aid budget, which was almost halved. Now, there are those that argue that that actually is potentially damaging for Britain's global national security and influence. But also, it was taking money from the world's most vulnerable. Do you think that was the right way to fund the defence increases?
Well, look, I think Keir himself said that this was a very, very difficult decision. And the truth about government is you'd have very difficult decisions to make. And it was absolutely necessary to increase defence spending. And I think, you know, this is a moment of massive, massive change when Europe has really got to step up. And I think Keir has shown incredible leadership by doing that on defence. And the truth about this government is that we face very, very difficult choices. And so obviously I support Keir and the decisions he's making.
Mm. I've got one last one I want to ask you, which is obviously as a government minister leading the net zero department, you will be making fundamental change, which will help us reach our net zero targets and address the climate crisis. What are you, Ed Miliband, doing about it in your own life? Well, how have you given up meat? Do you drive an electric car?
I am actually.
Do you turn off the lights?
So very late in life, I have become an absolutely avid cyclist. So
do you wear a helmet?
Definitely.
Yeah.
100%.
That's not a climate point. That's just you as a mother looking out for it, isn't it?
And, you know, my wife has been a cyclist throughout her life, and she has been trying to persuade me for the 20 years we've been together to become a cyclist. And, you know, I basically resisted for 17 of those years. And then and it was actually in lockdown that I suddenly realized this was a way to get around. And I'm not so good in the winter. I'm slightly fair weather. But I am a really avid cyclist. I confess it is an electric bike.
Oh, I was going to say, you're cheating.
I slightly cheat. Although the battery is now slightly on the blink, so it's become a pedal bike, actually. So that is my...
That's what he says. We'll have to check out the bike racks at Westminster, Kieran.
Yeah, that is my contribution.
Ed Miliband, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So Ed Miliband now left the room, presumably jump onto his electric bike.
Yep.
I'm very disappointed to hear that it wasn't a proper pedal one, despite his attempts to tell us that
I don't think it's any worse for the
working.
Environment, is it, for it to be an electric bike?
No, but it's just,
you're
you
right,
know.
It is cheating.
It is cheating. It is cheating. Anyway, sorry. He's a really interesting figure because not just because of longevity, he obviously was around, as he said, not just during the last Labour government, but before the last Labour government, he was an advisor to Gordon Brown. And he's kind of seen it all. He was in the Treasury for a long time. Obviously, that's the heart of most many government decisions. And so he's absolutely across all of that. And he also has been the party's leader and is steeped in Labour politics. So it has a perspective that nobody else in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet has. Yet he quite often is singled out as being somebody that's going out on a limb and maybe isn't quite aligned with the Labour project, which potentially makes it dangerous for him. And certainly there's some briefing against him from within the party on occasion. But it feels to me that whether it is the case that, as he says, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are incredibly supportive of this agenda, sometimes, you know, I doubt that. Mm-hmm. But it is the case that he and Starmer himself are very politically aligned. And what's been interesting about Starmer is that he's kind of done this shift from this soft left figure, much more sort of pragmatic to the centre, because I think of the political necessity of running the country and taking on the rise of the right-wing populists, the threat from that, that Ed Miliband doesn't have to do because he runs a department and he is as much focused on more focused on the policy than on the politics. But it does feel that maybe Starmer and Ed Miliband, because they actually share a political hinterland at heart, their instincts are very the same, that maybe that gives him a degree of protection.
Well, it's interesting. If we'd have had one more question, I would have asked him just to reflect a bit on exactly the point you're making, which is that he helped bring Keir Starmer into Parliament in the first place. When he was Labour leader back in the run-up to that 2015 election, Ed Miliband was instrumental in convincing Keir Starmer to stand as a Labour candidate and took quite a personal interest in it and in his career, and then kind of helped him when he was in his early days as an MP and on the shadow front bench as well. And what a fascinating relationship that those two people have. Ed Miliband must have thought at points that he would be the one as prime minister around the cabinet table, and maybe people like Keir Starmer would have been serving in his cabinet. Instead, it's the other way around. You know, what does that add to the dynamic? I think where I see differences in them is that Ed Miliband, and this is why I think he gets picked out as somebody who's slightly out on a limb, has a very clear worldview. Mm-hmm. He has a very clear set of values and principles, and you know what they are. And so when this government tacks to the right or sometimes to the left, or, you know, change his position on things, you always know what Ed Miliband's going to mm-hmm. think about it. And therefore, that can be quite exposing. Whereas Keir Starmer, you almost never know what he really thinks about it.
You just second guess it.
You're constantly having to second guess Keir Starmer. He's very shape-shifting as a politician in a way that Ed Miliband really isn't. And that's one of the things that I think hampered him in his leadership. He wasn't able to be as nimble and as mobile.
But then the focus now, and I think you're absolutely right on what you say about his values, and, you know, we hear words like mission quite a lot in government, but he really feels like somebody who has found his mission. And I've known and covered Ed Miliband for a very long time. I think I first met him in a club in Soho at a mutual friend's 40th birthday party on
Did
the
you?
Dance floor. Yes.
Was he dancing?
He was dancing, yes.
Uh-huh. Is he a good dancer?
Yeah, of course he was, you know. you make me blush now. But the big difference I see in him is that he has matured into feeling confident in what his values and beliefs are. And it feels like the Net Zero Department is a very good fit for him. I mean, he really cares about this stuff. Yeah. And he has all the weight of experience from last time round. And you speak to, you know, I speak to senior Tories, I speak to civil servants about which government departments are like up and running immediately. Because, of course, it's tough gig taking over after 14 years, and particularly if you've never run anything. He had the advantage of knowing what he wanted to do. He had the advantage of knowing from last time how to do it, because he was in the same department, as we said. And he's really hit the ground running. And everybody points to his department as one of those which is you know, moving quickly and has actually achieved quite a lot in quite a short period of time. So he's going to, we'll have to keep our eyes on him, Kieran. It's going to be really interesting to see not just what more the department can do, and I think probably some quite radical and bold things, but also whether he can maintain his position, you know, in one of the senior roles in government.
Well, look, let me just mention two issues that we talked about with him that I think are worth touching upon briefly. One of which is Heathrow. Now, we know that Ed Miliband is, we pretty much know that Ed Miliband is opposed to a third runway at Heathrow, whatever he says publicly. I, from what I'm told by senior people in the Labour Party, those who are opposed to the third runway are actually relatively comfortable at where the government is on this, because there is no planning application in. They think that there won't be a planning application for a while. And even if the planning application goes in, frankly, this project is unlikely to ever happen. I mean, you're talking about putting parts of the M25 underground and rerouting, I think, the M4.
You know, it's helpful signalling for them, isn't it? And that's fine.
And someone like Ed Miliband probably feels quite comfortable about that, because you think, well, you need to do a bit of signalling on one side, as long as, you know, you're not actually damaging the environment. Something that I think is going to be a much bigger source of tension, which I asked him about, is Rosebank. Now, this is an absolutely mammoth oil field off the coast of Shetland. I think this is going to be a really interesting source of tension within the government, because I think the Treasury would quite like that project to go ahead. It probably sees potential to generate tax revenue and jobs up in parts of Scotland that probably need it. And a lot is going to rest on what Ed Miliband's department, the Energy Department, now says about how we properly account for those carbon emissions. But let me just, he gave a very disciplined answer on that. We adhere to the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. But when I was putting to him the oil industry's argument that, look, you can't make us account for what people do with the product that we produce, he was rolling his eyes and giving me very skeptical looks. Now, I don't want to read too much into some facial expressions, but I would imagine that Ed Miliband would quite like that project not to go ahead, probably believes that it doesn't tally with our carbon commitments. And so I'm going to be watching that decision really, really carefully to see what comes out of that.
So there's lots of other things coming up this week which we'll be keeping our eyes on. Obviously, there's a planning reform bill on Tuesday, but it's also another big week for the future of Ukraine. And President Zelensky is in Saudi Arabia today to meet Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, before American and Ukrainian officials hold talks. And so more speculation about whether, after a very tumultuous couple of weeks, we could end up with a peace deal. Now, I think what we are likely to see is this much heralded critical minerals deal, which would result in American investment, major American investment in Ukraine taking place. And that being characterized by Donald Trump's administration is that is a security guarantee, because you'd have lots of American workers on the ground. You'd have billions of pounds of American investment, and that should be enough to deter Vladimir Putin and Russia in the event of a ceasefire, a peace deal, from reinvading. I mean, big, big question marks over that. But what we don't know yet is what the more immediate security guarantees that Europe is going to be leading on, Britain and France in particular, troops on the ground, what that would actually look like for us. And then the big unknown still is what Russia is going to have to compromise on. So far, most of the focus has been put on Ukraine by the White House and what Ukraine needs to give up and what Ukraine needs to accept. But the conversations between Putin and Trump have been done in private. We haven't heard anything from Trump about what he's asked Putin to do beyond the results of that very first phone call, where he made it clear that Ukraine would have to cede some territory, that Ukraine shouldn't be a member of NATO, which is obviously something that they want. There'll be big, big questions about whether what Russia is actually asked to do will be enough to satisfy Ukraine and Europe, including Britain, that they will be deterred from any future aggression.
Yeah, there are some indications now that we're starting to talk about where the border lies between the two countries. And that feels like, okay, for all of the noise of the last couple of weeks, where this was all really getting to was that specific conversation. Something else I think we're going to be watching out for is what on earth is happening within Reform UK. I say what on earth, but this is probably not very surprising. Parties led by Nigel Farage do have a habit of exploding in infighting. And what we've had over the last week is the, well, we would now say former Reform MP Rupert Lowe having the whip removed from him after, well, firstly, last Thursday, he gave an interview to the Mail where he decided to take a pop at Nigel Farage's leadership. Always an interesting thing to do, especially such a small party. Yep, went for the king. He could have said, well, I'm not sure that we're professional enough. I'm not sure that Nigel has what it takes to get us to where we need to be. The next day, the party then announces that there is an investigation going on to Rupert Lowe's conduct with bullying allegations and now a senior KC investigating him internally. He's had the whip removed and Reformer now.
He's denying
those allegations. He says it's all part of the party's backlash against him. That did get announced the day after he did his interview. Meanwhile, I mean, first of all, we've got to find out what happens with those allegations, but also, you know, watch the way in which Nigel Farage leads this party from here. What's quite interesting about this is that Rupert Lowe's challenge to Nigel Farage was actually from the right. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think has emboldened him, Rupert Lowe, this is in the last few weeks, was some supportive tweets from Elon Musk. And the thing is that Rupert Lowe does represent that part of the party that's quite interested in, perhaps enamored by, Trump-Musk-style conservatism, talks much more about immigration and about things like deportations, which is somewhere that Nigel Farage doesn't want to go. Nigel Farage has had long political experience and tends to know the sweet spot of the voters he's trying to target.
And what is Reform without Nigel Farage? One to be discussed in a future podcast, I'm sure. But that's all from us for now. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back on Thursday. And if you've got any questions for us or John or want to write in, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us a note to our email address, politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cocoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Enjoying this podcast? Then we think you might love the audio long read, the podcast of The Guardian Long Read, with episodes about caffeine addiction, the secret life of saints, and Britain's strangest pub chain. The Long Read offers great stories and big ideas. Follow the audio long read wherever you get your podcasts.